Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
It is that time on a Friday, the Friday Gathering. I'm joined in studio by Fine Gael Senator and Party Spokesperson on Justice Barry Ward, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fine Gael and Party Spokesperson on Enterprise, Trade and Employment, Alan Barrett, Director of the ESRI, and Louise Byrne, Political Correspondent at the Irish Mirror. Good morning to all four of you. Can I start with you first, Louise? You interviewed the Taoiseach during the week where he said that he felt safe walking around Dublin City. Was this with or without his Garda escort?
Yeah, that's right. Taoiseach sat down with the Irish Mirror earlier this week for a chat. And yeah, without his Garda escort, he said he felt safe walking around Dublin. Obviously, as Taoiseach, he does have Garda protection. But that was my exact question. Do you feel safe walking around without your guard? And he said he does. He said he would walk around without his guard regularly. He said that he's been to Parnell Street this week. He went to the cinema there. He's walked around O'Connell Street a few times. He's kind of accepted, and I think this is what a lot of people have been saying, that while Dublin is not 100% safe, neither are a lot of other places, and you always have that risk of something bad happening somewhere to you. But he, like Justice Minister Helen McEntee,
he's a 6'4" man as well, though, so the circumstances are somewhat different for him. Do you think he was aware of his privilege in that regard?
I don't know. We'd have to go back and ask him that. But I mean, I think, like when Helen McEntee said it, it has not necessarily gone down well with the public. And I was kind of reading some of the comments from our own readers and on social media, and a lot of people saying, well, just because you feel safe, that doesn't necessarily mean that's people's lived experience. And we know that a lot of people do not feel safe walking around Dublin. I mean, there's been times I haven't felt safe walking around Dublin, and we know that's a universal experience. And we know when we look at the amount of assaults that have been reported recently that things do seem to be escalating. So perhaps, you know, perhaps it's not what people want to hear, but I suppose you can't discount his own feelings or Helen McEntee's feelings on it either.
Barry Ward, would we still be talking about this? Would it even be an issue if Helen McEntee hadn't taken that ill-judged photo opportunity walking around the city centre?
I think we wouldn't be talking about this if there hadn't been an appalling attack on an innocent tourist. I think that's what has brought it to light. But it's not an issue that is new to the government, which is why there has been an unprecedented level of investment in Garda Síochána. Last year in the budget, there was provision made for 1,000 new Gardaí this year. More importantly, in my view, 400 civilian staff as well, to get Gardaí who are currently in stations out on the beat doing the policing that they need to do. That's why we're talking about it. But Louise is right. There are people who feel unsafe in Dublin. Now, I work in Dublin. Most days I'm on O'Connell Street very frequently. I don't feel unsafe in Dublin. That is not to say that other people don't feel unsafe. And it's not to say to people who don't feel unsafe that they're wrong to feel unsafe.
But why is your only solution to the problem Garda numbers?
It's not the only solution. In fact, if you listen to what
Helen McEntee talked about.
No, that's that is one thing that went into the budget last year. But Helen McEntee has talked about solutions at community levels, putting in place non-Garda solutions to encourage people to have a community responder, somebody who's there to act as a liaison, working with communities who are disadvantaged to ensure that there are alternatives, particularly for young people who might be trapped into a criminal kind of spiral. All of those things are being put in place. And the task force for the Northeast Inner City, for example, there's a lot of measures being put in place, not just Gardaí, but the issue that has come up time and time again from people is they say they don't see guards on the street in Dublin city centre. That has to change. There must be a visible policing. We know that visible policing is a deterrent to criminal activity as well, and that's why increased numbers of Gardaí are part of Fine Gael's plan to deal with it, but only one part of a broader plan to deal with crime generally across the country. And it's not just a Dublin issue. It happens in towns, villages, cities all over the country.
Louise O'Reilly, Dublin is a comparatively safe city, really, though, isn't it? I mean, in spite of all of the headlines that we've seen in the course of the last 2 weeks, you're safer here than you are in most European capitals.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the situation in Dublin has deteriorated. Earlier on this week, my colleague, Pat Daly, who's Sinn Féin spokesperson on justice, along with Councillor Janice Boylan and others, did a walkabout. They met with traders in the Talbot Street, O'Connell Street area. And what they're saying is there has been a difference, an increase in antisocial behaviour, an increase in theft, and an increase in them struggling to recruit staff. So it is all very well for Helen McEntee, flanked by half a dozen guards, to say she feels safe.
Two.
It's very, very well for on Taoiseach, as you say, a 6'4" man, to say that he feels safe. But what the traders were saying is when they have people locking up at night, they don't feel safe, and that people don't feel safe coming in out of hours when it's dark, that they don't feel safe I'm a Dub. I love Dublin. I love Dublin City and County. I want it to be safe. I want it to be a place that people actively want to come to. But we can't ignore the fact that there are now advisories coming out of embassies from the States and other places telling people to be extra careful in Dublin City. Now, that should serve as a wake-up call for the government. And the solution of a stick and plaster of €10 million extra for overtime for the Gardaí, that is simply not going to work. Because if you talk to the Gardaí, they will tell you that they are burnt out, that they're doing all the overtime that they can. It is not an attractive place to work, and it needs to be made an attractive place to work. That requires additional recruitment, absolutely, but it also requires the government to look at how they can ramp that up in a very quick and efficient way.
Alan Barrett, feeling safe is a very, very subjective test, isn't it? Do we have the stats and the figures to justify whether we are right or wrong to feel safe or unsafe in Dublin?
We probably do to a degree, but we don't have the full story. I mean, I have to say, as the researcher in me always sort of says, okay, well, let's look at the statistics. And crime is a curious issue that very, very often you have situations where the crime isn't actually increasing, but when it's reported a lot, all of a sudden people feel more unsafe. So I'm not saying it's irrational, but it's just one of those strange issues. From my own perspective, I mean, you can look at this, the statistics, but of course the difficulty in this is that so much of this crime is simply not reported. And the sort of level of crime that we're talking about, where it's sort of intimidating behaviour, there might be, you know, low level punching or whatever like that, very, very few people. And we're back to the issue then about, you know, partly the number of guards, but also the judicial process and procedures as well. I mean, a lot of, you know, if somebody is thumped on a street, the chances that they report it and the chance that they'll start trying to get somebody prosecuted is probably very limited. Mm. So that sort of stuff just doesn't show up in the statistics. So you have this sort of grey area where the statistics are only telling part of the story. In this situation, I think people's sort of lived experiences is probably more relevant. And I mean, I, for one, like so many other people, have been in the North Inner City, have late at night seen people being attacked. It's really, really terrifying. And I have to say, you know, while the researcher in me said always look at the data, when you see it and when you feel it, it really doesn't matter actually at a certain point what the statistics say.
Let me ask you, or let me ask rather the researcher in you, a question to address the recruitment and retention problem within An Garda Síochána. Is there a salary point at which people will feel that Gardaí are likely to feel satisfied with what they're doing, or are the issues more likely to be around work conditions?
There's probably a bit of both. I mean, as with all things, you can always find a salary, make it higher and higher and higher, that you're going to attract more and more people. But I think, you know, one of the challenges for all people recruiting at the moment is simply that the outside, with unemployment so low and the labour market so buoyant, there are lots of good opportunities facing people. So when you look at a group like the Guards, it's not just, well, what do we have to offer? You have to think about what are the outside of, what else could people be doing? And how do we make this particular role more attractive? Now, I think one of the things Louise touched actually on this earlier on, like being a guard, in many ways, it's like it's the ultimate in public service. OK, and recruit, you know, employers like me are often, you know, told at the moment that really what people want on the job is not just about money. It's about having a meaningful career. It's about sort of contributing to your society. So I think the difficulty of the guards at the moment is a lot of their conditions seem to be terribly demanding. OK, so it's more that the conditions are more negative than positive. But you really need to transition things in such a way that you're, you know, in recruitment campaigns, re-emphasizing that public sector dimension. But can I just make one other quick point? Like, traditionally, public sector jobs were attractive, partly for reasons of things like pensions and stability. OK, but in the Guards, we have this very curious situation that you can't join after the age of 35. OK, now, in my experience of interviewing people, like people in their 20s never ask about pensions. People in their 40s always ask about pensions. OK, so when you have a recruitment structure that is almost saying this is sort of a young person's game. So the changing of the 35 thing, I think, could be important. OK, but in addition to sort of saying to people you can join at the age of 35, nobody wants to join the Guards and then being on the first point of the, you know, if you've been working for quite a while, you don't want an entry level post. But it strikes me, I mean, again, being a guard, you know, there are so many skills and competencies, you know, available. I can imagine lots of people who have had lots of experience in their lives in their late 30s, early 40s, who would make brilliant guards, whose sort of previous career should be recognised. OK, so they're not just starting on the first rung, and that there's a potential talent pool that we're simply not exploring.
Barry Wood, simply put, you've got to get an awful lot more creative about recruiting to the guards.
And I think that's I mentioned civilianisation earlier. There has to be a role for people with particular skills to come into a Garda Síochána. So looking at, for example, detective ranks, somebody who's been an accountant and understands company accounts for white collar crime and things like that. There's a huge value in bringing that person in at a high level at a detective rank to help investigating crimes like that. There's a whole range of skill sets out there that could be brought into the guard. So I think we not only need to look at raising the age at which people can enter in Garda Síochána, but also raising the retirement age. It shouldn't be the case that Gardaí who don't want to retire, who want to continue working and are in a position to keep working, should also be allowed to work, because that deals with the problem at the other end, because we know also the retirements are affecting the number of Gardaí available for service.
The real question seems to be, why is government acting so slowly on this? I mean, we've seen the numbers going through Temple Moore. They're way below what was expected. Like last week, they expected 200 to graduate. I think 89 passed out. We're seeing discussions.
That's about the suitability of candidates, though, rather than the actual recruitment, isn't it?
I think 600 applied. But if you look at the attrition rate, you know, if you're only taking 200 in per term, whatever, you know, you would expect some to fall off. So why is it just a set number of 200? Should we be perhaps looking at increasing the intake rate and taking more and more in each time? And as well, you need to look at the conditions and the kind of circumstances that are surrounding the guards right now. We have a situation where a Garda union is talking about tabling a motion no confidence in the commissioner over a dispute about rosters. Why is the government not stepping in there to say, well, is there anything else we can do? Can we look at this? Can we look at that? Because I've been speaking to guards and I've read articles of other people speaking to guards where they're saying, well, if these rosters change, you're going to have people walking away because they're just not suitable. So I think it's a question of why is the government not being proactive on this, and as usual, is being reactive and not taking steps to prevent things from happening.
Fine Gael of the Party of Law and Order, Louise O'Reilly, would Sinn Féin do any better?
Well, I think at this stage, what needs to happen is people need to start listening to members of An Garda Síochána. I've had members of An Garda Síochána in my office facing homelessness. And that's a place I never thought that we would get to. I think it's very obvious after 12 years of Fine Gael in government, 12 years of Fine Gael justice ministers, morale in An Garda Síochána has never been lower. When you talk to officers,
We don't associate Sinn Féin with supporting the Gardaí.
The morale among An Garda Síochána is very low at the moment.
If you want to talk about investment in the guards, Louise, Fine Gael has done that in spades. Louise talked about 200 euro per term. That's every 2 months.
And it's not working. No. And the offer of a stick and plaster of 10 million euros of overtime is proof that your party have failed,
that your party is out of ideas.
So there are a number of things you can do. One is you can look at the training model. So if you establish a hybrid training model where you've got half of your recruits training on the job, the other half in Temple Moor, that means you double the output. You can also make a commitment in terms of actually hitting targets and develop some kind of rapport with the guards, because that's gone.
But they have
now,
made
Barry.
A commitment
that
to hitting targets.
That has gone, but they have missed their targets. So you need to talk to members of An Garda Síochána, put a plan in place for recruitment. And you also need to look at issues that are really affecting people's lives, such as transport. Public transport, a transport policing unit is very, very much required. And yet the government provided nothing for this in the budget. So when you ask what we would do, we had put money aside in our alternative budget for that. We do want to see a hybrid model working. We want to see the guards given powers to tackle issues like scramblers, which are a scourge in not just my community, but in all communities, not just in Dublin and right across
the
state.
You asked what she would do. She hasn't answered that.
There are two parallel issues that Louise is talking about there. On the one hand, there's the recruitment. Nobody has invested as much in recruitment of An Garda Síochána as Fine Gael has. We will deliver over 800 Gardaí this year. The target was 1,000, but that isn't always possible. And it's not the case that there isn't hybrid training. You do have Gardaí who, before they're properly attested, they are out in stations. And you do have people in Temple Moor and in stations as well at the same time. But then Louise goes on to talk about other policing issues, and of course there are issues. But Sinn Féin is not synonymous with support from the Gardaí.
Barry,
in fact, quite the opposite. The reality is Louise, hang on a second, Louise. You're talking about short term. And then you go on to talk about a transport police. That's not going to help people get into the Gardaí. That's not something that's going to drive people into the recruitment. The reality is that we have a huge recruitment. As you said, Philip, over 600 people are applying for where there are not the places available for them, or there are issues with them because it takes time to vet them
you're
or whatever it might
targets,
be. But if people want
you're
to become guards,
the
they should come.
You're missing them
so
by
hang
miles.
On a second, Louise. The target,
they are resigning from the force, making your targets.
Louise, The target for this year was 1,000 Gardaí. There will be more than 800. And there will
that's
be
not
more.
A thousand, though,
that's right. You're right. It's not the target.
Not
but there are lots of factors that come into not making that target.
And then when
it's
you
not,
factor in the resignations,
let me finish the sentence.
It's not
for
the
want,
it's not for the want of trying. It's not for the want of a really good recruitment campaign that specifically targeted the notion of, as Alan was talking about earlier, the notion that you're going into more than just a job, but a career, a vocation, a job that is really fulfilling, where you can actually deliver results for a community. Just because we didn't make the target this year does not mean we haven't made huge strides forward in terms of putting guards on the street and unprecedented investment in a Gardaí economy.
All right, I'd like to move on, if I can, please, and to the possibility of a referendum on the right to housing. Louise Byrne, first off, is it going to happen, do you think?
There's been a lot of questions over this recently, and I think this was a programme for government commitment, and any time it's asked about, it's you don't really seem to get a concrete answer from anyone. We know there's local and European elections next June. It was kind of suggested that perhaps it could be then. We know from Jack Horgan-Jones reporting in the Irish Times earlier this week that there's disagreement now within the Housing Commission about what exactly this referendum would do, what part of the constitution it would change, whether it would be legally binding that people would have a right to housing. There seems to be some disagreement. We now know that the report that we were meant to get could be two reports. We're not going to get it in July. July's gone. We might get it later in the year. So it's really up in the air, to be honest. We don't know when we're going to have it, if we're going to have it, or when it's going to be. And that has kind of been the situation for the last couple of months, where you just can't get a concrete answer on whether this referendum will be held.
Barry?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Louise is right. It's a commitment to the programme for government, and there has been a lot of discussion on it. My own view is that it's not necessary. The reality is that changing the constitution to create a right to housing is not going to put a single bedroom house brick in place in terms of housing. There are other plans in place to do that. The other difficulty is...
The reason that you say that is because this government is scared witless that if it was such a thing as a right to housing, you would have queues all the way down the Dublin Quays to the four courts of people saying, I want to vindicate this right.
To my mind, that is the other difficulty. And the Housing Commission is made up of not of lawyers and constitutional experts who understand the
consequences.
That's
not true. There are constitutional experts.
But it's not made up of them. It's mostly housing experts. And that's as it should be, which is why I haven't seen the reports any more than anyone else, but I have a real concern that if you create a right to housing, two things. Firstly, is it justiciable? Is it enforceable? Is it a situation where somebody can sue on foot of that right, which then creates a myriad of knock-on effects? But if not, what's the point?
No, but it's usually supported by secondary legislation is the point.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand that. But what I'm saying is it is not the case that there isn't a will to put in place housing. It's not the case, for example, that the state is not doing its damnedest to provide housing. There is an unprecedented demand for housing. We know the historic basis on which there has been a deficit in the number of houses being built in this country. I just don't believe, this is a personal view, I don't believe that a referendum on this is going to change that fact.
Louise O'Reilly, big, flashy, feel-good statements of political aspirations like this don't really ever translate into meaningful actions that change people's lives, do they?
Well, I would have thought that something that was in the programme for government should be something that would be supported by all of the parties in it. But anyway, that aside, I suppose we all know that the housing crisis will only be resolved through a comprehensive programme of building social and affordable housing, proper regulation in the private rented sector, and all of the things that the government are failing abysmally.
So does a year-long referendum campaign distract from that?
No, I think what it will do is it will give us an opportunity to have that statewide conversation about what having a home means. It will give us an opportunity to look really at the reality behind the statistics. So it's 12,600 people in emergency accommodation. That's before you count those people in domestic abuse shelters, people couch surfing, people who are sleeping in their cars, etc., etc. 4,000 of those are children. And I think for them, we do have to have that conversation about what
it
means
to have
a home.
Okay, but can you answer my question, please? Do you think that a insertion of one or two lines into the constitution is going to unlock any of those process or system problems that are currently clogging up the housing system?
Okay, so a change of government is the only thing that's going to resolve the housing crisis, Philip. That's very obvious. Because
that wasn't my question.
No,
though.
But I mean, it remains a fact that a change of government is the only way that we will resolve the housing crisis.
I admire your creativity in the way that you always find to insert that into the conversation.
However, on the issue of a constitutional referendum. Okay, but that remains. The fact of government policies are here. 12,600 people in emergency accommodation. That is a fact. 4,000 of those are children. That is a fact. So what we need is to focus the government on and focus their attention on housing. I mean, to me, they have proven themselves singularly incapable of resolving the crisis because, in part, They created the crisis. I understand the people who created the crisis will never be the ones to solve the crisis.
I know how you feel about the government. We all know how you feel about the government. How do you feel about a referendum and whether we should have one or not?
I think we should. And I think it would start an important conversation. I think it would also point the government in the direction of actually resolving the crisis. I think it would put an important legal obligation. It wouldn't in and of itself build a house. It wouldn't in and of itself house people. What it would do is it would give people an opportunity to let the government know how they feel.
So should it be a priority then?
Well, I think it can happen, and I think it should be, because it is a commitment that was given. My understanding is it was a commitment given by all political parties. So there's unanimity on it. We should have a referendum on the right to housing. We will have an opportunity because there's elections coming up. There is an opportunity there to do that, and I think we should have that. Yeah,
Alan Barrett, what do you think?
Well, my comes as surprise to Louise that she's just convinced me that we don't need a referendum on the right to housing. If the argument is that the real value of this is that it would prompt a conversation and give us time and space to discuss the issues, in fairness to Louise, I think you've been brilliant and your party has been brilliant at having that conversation and making sure that everybody's had that conversation. You know, I think we all know the challenges. I don't know how often I've been in this studio and been discussing housing. So I'm not entirely sure that we need a referendum to spur the conversation. And I mean, you put the question quite directly to Louise, what would be the great advantage? And if it's only beginning the conversation, I don't see it. Like, Marion, like the, sort of the way your question was coming, nobody has explained to me how this will actually have a positive impact in any real sense on housing. Now, just if I can draw one small parallel, I had a similar issue in terms of putting environmental targets into law as well. OK, so you know the way this idea of the 51% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions out to 2030, that's in law. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I didn't understand these sort of things. So for quite a while, I was asking people, well, what does it mean to have that in law? OK, who's going to sue who if the targets are missed? What, you know, what's the effect going to be? But over time, people have explained to me, actually, that the real value in that is, say, for example, there's a planning application to build some sort of a facility that's going to be a major emitter of greenhouse gases. OK, people can imagine a situation in which they will now go to the courts and say, well, you have to block this because it's contrary to the legally binding targets. So that's a situation in which an activity is, in a sense, constrained.
That's all very theoretical, though, isn't it, Alan?
Well, I agree.
But we had a referendum on the rights of the children. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the state of child and adolescent mental health services this week.
But this is the point,
Philip. That's a failure of government. That's a failure of government
exactly.
policy.
But the Constitution didn't make any difference. The Constitution
should guide not just this government, but future governments. It should guide their policies, and they should be guided by that obligation.
But is the point not that the practice is not a reason to not have the referendum? No, but Louise, is the point not that practice has shown that these constitutional referendums don't make a whit of difference to the people whose lives need to be changed?
Well, I think they can do. The fact that they haven't is a government issue, but I think that they can do. And I think what we need to see then is, with that right in the Constitution, to see it guiding the policies and the legislation, not just for this government, but for future
governments. Final point on this, Louise Byrne.
You would wonder, though, like, what kind of shape a referendum campaign on this would take. Like, I don't think anyone is going to come out and campaign that, saying that people shouldn't have the right to have a home. I don't think that's going to happen. So you do have to question, would it be worthwhile? Would it just automatically pass? Are you going to have that back and forth? Like, how's a programme like this going to have balance when you're having a discussion? How are you going to have someone sitting in the corner going, no, I don't think people should have a home. I think people should live on the street. So you kind of have to look at it from that point of view as well. And is there any point in getting people out to vote? Is there any point in putting money behind it, state money behind it? Are you going to get anyone out to vote at all? These things also have to be taken into consideration.
The Sex for Rent programme, something that the Examiner had done quite a lot of work on, and obviously Primetime Investigates this week has as well. The Taoiseach has said, Barry, that there are existing laws already to cover this crime. What law does it fall under, and do you think it might need to be amended?
No, I mean, I think it's very clear that people who create that ultimatum say to somebody that, you know, you may rent this room, but coming with that is the obligation that the sexual service will be provided. I think that is a serious sexual offence. Without overstating it, I think it's something that people should understand is a serious sexual offence, because it's not transactional the way certain sexual services might be provided. There is an element of duress in there, which I think puts it in a different category. Now, there are other areas in which it's definitely...
So therefore, a new law that expressly says the state thinks you're a sleazebag if you do something like this and will take action against you is needed, no?
I think we're well beyond sleazebag territory, Philip. Like, what you're talking about here is creating a situation where somebody is under duress to provide sexual service or a sexual act. That is well beyond sleazebag.
But my point is that the existing laws are such that anybody who is propositioned in this manner is, look, they're a house hunter, they have other things to be getting on with. Anybody who is coerced into this situation is in a vulnerable position that they're not going to be able to vindicate their rights with the existing laws. So is a new law needed?
Well, there's two things. Firstly, anybody who's coerced can vindicate that right. There is a law against that. Now, one of the proposals I know that is out there is that it would become an offence either to make that proposal or to advertise that proposal. I have no difficulty whatsoever with that becoming against the law. I think it's something that should be against the law. It isn't at the moment. It's not a specific offence. Mm-hmm. It is certainly, if somebody did enter into that arrangement, certainly there are offences under the Residential Tenancies Acts which prevent the person from peaceably enjoying the property they're renting. But in terms of what is actually happening, what we saw on that programme, which is pretty shocking for everybody, I have no doubt, as a practitioner of criminal law, that it is a serious sexual offence what it was being proposed to those people. If it actually went ahead and there was an element of duress, I think it is a serious matter.
Louise O'Reilly, it is a particularly hard one to legislate for, though, isn't it? Because ultimately it comes down to a he said, she said.
It is, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And I think, Barry is right. An amendment to the Residential Tenancies Act is the way to go. I know my colleague, Ona Brin, has published legislation and put it on the order paper just this week. I was really shocked, now I have to say, by what I saw in the programme. And it probably shouldn't come as a shock because of the good work done by the examiner. So this is something that's been known about for at least 2 years now and probably more. So I think really we do need to do something. I don't accept that what exists there already is enough, because clearly this was highlighted 2 years ago and then 2 years elapsed and prime time still were able to find quite an amount of evidence that this practice continues. So that to me underlines the need to take action. But let's not forget, in a dysfunctional housing market such as the one that has been created here, you do have a disproportionate level of power with landlords, and tenants and prospective tenants are in a very desperate situation, which I think creates the conditions for these kind of disgusting practices to develop. Notwithstanding that, I think there will be all-party consensus on stamping them out. It's very regrettable that when, I think it was either the Social Democrats or the Labour Party tried to legislate for this previously, the government kicked that to touch and voted it down. But I think now there is an appetite for that legislation. I think it's clear that what's there is not working, because in the 2 years between the examiner doing their work first and RTE doing their work secondly, this practice appears not stopped.
Louise Byrne, should be an easy one. I mean, there would be an awful lot of cross-party consensus on this, wouldn't there?
You would imagine so, but I think it comes back to what the Taoiseach said in the Irish Examiner during the week, that we should have more prosecutions. There aren't enough prosecutions, but the law is there to prosecute people. Well, if the law is there to prosecute people, then why aren't people being prosecuted? And I think if that's the case, you would imagine that more law is needed. Now, you would imagine that there would be cross-party consensus, but Kino Callaghan of the Social Democrats, as Louise has already said, did bring proposals very similar to what Owen O'Brien has brought this week, and
but
they
in committee stage the wording was found to be too loose.
So like, if the you would have to think now that the government will have to look at this again and will have to look at it seriously, because I think when you saw that undercover from prime time, it really put into light how much this is happening and how horrid it is.
Louise Byrne, thank you very much, and as well to Barry Ward, Louise O'Reilly and Alan Barrett. We will have to leave the conversation there and indeed the programme while we take our final break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.